Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. Running a not-for-profit arts organization in New York City is no easy task. Just ask Kevin Cunningham, the founder and executive artistic director of Three-Legged Dog Media and Theater Group and 3LD Art and Technology Center, a cutting-edge theater dance performance space that specializes in large-scale interdisciplinary artworks using the latest in digital technology. Three-Legged Dog has received many awards and commissions and shown at prestigious venues like the Venice Biennale, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and the Sundance Film Festival. We have invited Mr. Cunningham to our show today to talk about how new art forms like virtual reality can be used by artists and what it takes to develop and present these works in a challenging economic environment. Welcome to our show.
Hi.
What was Three-Legged Dog's concept when you first started it, and why did you give it that name?
Well, I have a bad habit of taking over industrial spaces and turning them into art centers. And the first one I started was a place called Commerce Street Artist Warehouse in Houston, Texas, 1983. And as we were cleaning it out, we found a little pit bull puppy and named him Sid, and he became our mascot.
But he only had 3 legs?
Well, at that time he had 4, but he developed this habit of jumping off of the loading dock and chasing cars. But rather than chasing behind the car, he would run around and try to bite the front sidewall. Mm-hmm. So he lost his left front leg. And we bandaged him up, took him to the vet, and he was sitting on the loading dock, and a car came by, and off he went. And now the leg wasn't in the way, so he could get a chomp on the sidewall and sort of roll off. He became a symbol of persistence of vision.
But he's long gone,
I suspect.
Did you begin simply as a theater, dance, and performance group, or has working with new technology always been part of your mission?
Well, I started as a sculptor in Houston, and at some point I became bored with my sculptures just sitting there, and I began incorporating audio and video into my sculptures very early on. So it's sort of a modus operandi for me. Yeah.
Houston, actually, it's interestingly one of the great art cities of America, not only great museums, but it has a lot of separate buildings devoted to artists or to styles of art. Was technology something that was already being talked about at the time, the new technologies?
It was, but not as intensely as it is now. You know, at Three-Legged Dog, we've come to the point where we see that technology is changing the way artists make art and the way that audiences experience it, and we've sort of embraced that.
And you've been doing this for over 30 years now. Mm-hmm. How has the technology available to you changed over that time?
Oh, my God. It's a huge, huge shift. You know, our first show was done at the Ontological Theater. That's where we started. I was Richard Foreman's designer and in-house technical director, and he saw one of my scripts. And that piece had 8 channels of video in it with video talking to live performers. And that at that time, we had borrowed tape decks and a really fast guy named Kitty punching a push-button switcher matrix. And things have changed really radically since then.
You don't need the fast guy.
We don't. No, the technology really does come to the performers now, and that's been our focus in technology development.
Your mission statement reads in part, Three-Legged Dog believes in the power of technology to amplify human experience and human expression, provoking empathy and complex reflection, thought, and action. Technology is a way to provoke empathy?
Yes. Yeah, definitely. And
we need more empathy in this country, don't you?
We do. We produced, I think, in a lot of ways, it was sort of the the most important production we've ever done, an immersive work called 3/5 by the playwright James Scruggs, which was we took over the entire 12,000 square feet of the facility and turned it into a place called Supremacy Land. And when you walk into the space, you decide whether you're going to be black or white, and you're treated accordingly through the experience. And
I hope you didn't have any politicians from Virginia attending.
We used VR, we used interactive technology, we had about 42 channels of video in that piece, and it's probably the only piece that we've done that I can say I know that at least 60% of the people who came to that piece left permanently changed in the way they think. And so it was very powerful, and part of that was using technology to help people put themselves in someone else's shoes.
Your group just presented several virtual reality works at the Sundance Film Festival, one called Esperpento by Victor Morales. Is it Anilmush?
Anilmush.
Anilmush by Matt Romaine and Dirt Screen by Peter Burr. As I understand it, Esperpento denotes a literary style in Spanish that uses distorted descriptions of reality in order to criticize society.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Can you describe the work?
So Victor is a Venezuelan refugee artist here in the United States. He's been here for a while, and he worked in Germany for a while. He's probably the artist that's worked the longest and the most successfully using gaming engines in live performance. He's been doing that for about 13 years. And he created a world based on Francisco Goya's 82 Esperpento paintings and also inspired by the poetry of Valle Inclán. The world of Esperpento is basically the setting, the scenery for the play. And then there are live performances that happen inside that.
All of these things include live performances. Anilmush, which is a studio visual means a studio visual performance tool.
They're very different. This is what one of the interesting things about the work we've been doing and the work we took to Sundance is over the last 18 months we've been working on what we call an immersive platform. And we've done a lot of work on the technology side to make sure that no matter how the artist approaches the work or what technologies they use to create it, they can easily just step in and take over the space.
Were they official selections of the Sundance Festival, or were they presented in a separate section?
They were. They were official selections in the New Frontiers
section. So they
were
presented just as though they were films, in a sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a new program there, relatively new, called New Frontiers that Shari Frilo runs that's been really instrumental in bringing forward different ways that artists work to tell stories with technology.
Most of the people I've spoken to admit that they have a rather hazy understanding of virtual reality. So perhaps we can devote a few minutes to having you explain exactly what it is. Is it a kind of 3D film process?
It is similar to a 3D film process, but the thing is that virtual reality and augmented reality have become sort of catchphrases, the same way immersive theater has become a catchphrase. There's a very specific meaning to virtual reality. This is a technology where you put on a headset and you're immersed completely in a visual world. Sometimes there are haptic elements, little vibrations and sound. But
so is the work projected onto the goggles?
It's projected through the goggles, yes. But there are new technology coming out where they're using retinal projectors that project the image directly onto your retina.
Wow.
And we saw some of that with some leap motion technology at Sundance this year.
And all of that's done using computers?
It uses computers to output and process the media.
How long has VR technology been around?
Gosh, I'm not sure. You know, I think I remember it coming out in the late 90s. For a long time, it was problematic because people have physiological responses to it. They still are having those physiological responses, but not as much.
I remember putting on the goggles once because I did a radio show about it, and I was impressed. But I didn't think, oh, gee, I got to do this again. There have to be reasons to convince people to go through all of that.
Right. Well, that's the thing is we're kind of – I personally am a little skeptical about it, actually.
Even though you do so much of it?
Well, we work in virtual reality mode, but most of the work we do actually happens in the real world, and we are really interested in interactivity and immersion without any kind of intermediary physical technology.
Well, you've been using those words. I thought, aren't there those two different types of virtual reality, immersive and interactive?
Yes, I guess you can say that.
Or do they merge?
Well, We use what we call mixed reality, basically, which is a mix of different technologies to create an environment that the audience is in. We would prefer to do our work with the audience than at the audience.
So the viewers feel that they're embedded in a physical space that isn't actually there?
Yes, sometimes yes, but sometimes it is there, right? There's a mix. So, for example, right now what we're working on is a set of techniques, some of them from the 19th century, that will allow us to start out with a beautiful close-up, like classic Hollywood close-up on the screen. The camera will pull out so that the figure is life-size. This figure will walk off the screen onto the stage. We've already done this. And now we're working on having the figure walk off the stage out into the audience and give you a kiss. So there's a comprehensive, apparent bridge between cinematic reality and everyday reality. And in between those two things is where everything happens.
Do you see VR as more powerful than film and theater because it puts the viewer inside the experience rather than kind of watching it from the outside?
I think that's its strength. I think that's its purpose. There was a piece at Sundance in 2015 that was made by an independent artist. It was shot with a bunch of GoPros that were hot glued together. That was the 3D camera that they used. And you found yourself in the middle of a college party in the body of a young man. And as you went through
the
story...
Women found themselves in the body of a young man as well.
They did, yes. And as you went through the story, you experienced the young man date raping young woman.
Ooh.
Then you went into the bedroom and experienced it from the young woman's point of view. And so that was an extremely powerful use of virtual reality because you're actually put into a person's emotional situation and body.
And there was a controversial VR piece in a recent Whitney biennial in which viewers witnessed a vicious beating, which seemed mm-hmm. to be a hate crime. So does the fact that it was presented in VR make it more personal, harder for people to dissociate from?
What we've experienced, we did a
piece. I'm not sure I want to feel raped.
Right, yeah. Well, but it's, I have to say, you know, in that particular piece at Sundance, one of the things that impressed me were the young men were coming out of the experience with really obvious, deeply changed ideas about mm-hmm. how they treat young women. So I think it has its place.
One notable thing about VR is that the viewer is isolated while watching it. Does that make mm-hmm. it less of a communal experience than sitting in a theater with other people?
I think it does, and I think that's one of its fallbacks. Yeah, mm-hmm. We were called by a friend of ours in Shanghai who was starting a big experience there, a big theme park, and his investors were requiring him to do a 300-seat VR theater. Within 2 weeks, people were starting to have skin infections, the wires were going off, everything was sort of falling apart. And so what he was calling us for was to ask us to make an unmediated immersive experience to replace it. And it has its issues, it has problems.
Yeah, well, you don't want to sit around with a whole bunch of people with goggles on.
Right, yeah.
A headpiece on.
Yeah.
That's kind of, it separates you from everybody else. On the other hand, when you watch a movie, or especially if you watch TV, there's something kind of passive about the experience.
It can be.
And this is not passive.
Right. Well, so that's one of the reasons that we moved away from frontal presentation to create these designs that completely surround the audience with moving image, sound, and bodies. And we find that actually we've done a lot of experimentation with this. And, for example, we find that making sure that the setting is asymmetric is very important. If it's symmetrical, a dome or a circular, people tend to fall asleep.
Really?
We call it the drool effect. You know? You'll see it at IMAX films too, where people are just sort of sitting there with their mouths open, staring mm-hmm. up at the ceiling. Or at a theater, you know, you go to a theater and if you look around, you'll see people my age sort of nodding off 20 minutes in, even if the thing is loud and very, very good, you know.
With me, it's usually watching television around 11:30 at night.
Right.
And suddenly I'll wake up and say, did I miss?
Yeah, so we find that if it's asymmetric and we continually sort of tease on the peripheral edges, people wake up and pay attention in a different way.
Well, how do you create a virtual reality piece? Does it require a lot of specialized equipment? Is there a VR camera, like a video camera?
Yeah, there are VR cameras, but you can also create VR with stitching by using standard cameras and stitching the image together, or through animation. There are many different processes.
So if you're stitching, you're editing all of the different the things from the multiple cameras together?
Mm-hmm. The different
and
frames.
And you're doing that in a computer, right? So.
Yeah, you're doing that in a computer. But that's the same thing we do with large-scale immersive video with mapping.
It sounds very labor intensive.
It can be, but that's one of the things we've been able to do at 3LD is our technological innovations have been aimed at creating processes that allow artists to do these sophisticated processes affordably.
Do VR artists also need to be computer programmers?
They don't. They don't.
But collaborate with a programmer?
They do need to have access to people who can do that, usually.
Film festivals have begun to include virtual reality works in their programming. Is that tricky because all the viewers need to have their own headsets? That's a lot more complicated than just handing out 3D glasses.
Right. Which is why we brought a big immersive stage to Sundance instead of a virtual reality piece. Yeah. So there are a lot of different...
What does an immersive stage mean?
So an immersive stage is all... In this case, it was a 20 by 40 foot room, basically, that's completely covered in moving image. Mm-hmm. And there's an immersive sound system also. So Victor's piece, Esperpento, was built in a gaming engine called Unreal Engine, and it can be experienced as a virtual reality work also. But we, instead of stitching onto a virtual reality setup, we mapped it onto walls.
So it's so sitting in a 360-degree environment,
yes.
In effect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's like wearing the goggles, except you're not wearing the goggles.
You're not wearing the goggles, yeah, which is what we like. So it elicits a more communal experience, but the same sort of feeling of being inside the work.
I'm speaking with Kevin Cunningham of Three-Legged Dog. We are talking about one of the latest tools for artists on Let It Lope It At Large on WNYC, New York. Not WNYC, WBAI, New York, 99.5 FM. Boy, I just said a dirty word. Aren't these also prone to technical glitches, which can shut them down at times, leaving the viewers kind of frustrated?
They can, yes, but that's sort of a function of the technology. That's who built the technology and also who's using it. So we're able to do these larger scale immersive works. For example, the piece we did in Shanghai, we were commissioned by Michael Kors to do his Shanghai brand launch, and we created an immersive environment about 27,000 square feet and a holographic projection system that was large enough to land a jet on stage. So
wow. I suspect many of our listeners would like to get into this discussion. We invite your calls. Our number here is 212-209-2877. Because a lot of our listeners are involved in the arts, and they probably would like to ask questions about what they would able to be do, and also how to do it financially. But is right now this is mostly being used by artists? Is it going to be moving into the entertainment world?
It is. I would say virtual reality specifically is more driven by the entertainment world at this point than artists.
So yes. Are there now some commercial virtual reality arcades coming up?
I've
kind
seen
of like a video game experience.
Yeah, I've seen a few of them, but mostly it's been marketed as a personal experience. So this is one of the reasons that we're working with Nokia Bell Labs Experiments in Art and Technology, is that they're concerned with the drive of technology toward a sort of solipsistic way of experiencing it. You see people walking down the street with their cell phones in front of their faces all the time.
Yes.
And they're working on disaggregating the cell phone, and some other companies are too, so that you have the capability to hear and see and move around without a device in your hand. And the same thing, I think, is true with virtual reality, that there's an emphasis on moving towards augmented reality, where you may have a device on, but you can see everything in the real world around you as you experience
the same time.
Layer of other reality. Yeah.
Can't people now buy their own VR headsets, like the Oculus Rift?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
What do you do? Connect them to your home computer?
Yeah, you can connect them to your home computer, and there are other systems, Xbox and those kind of systems.
And how do users find content to view in them?
It's all online and available.
This is a new technology. How much of the work is the work about just mastering the equipment and the techniques?
Well, I think it was really interesting. There was a resurgence sort of in virtual reality work after the Sundance Festival in 2015. And what we saw in our world anyway was a lot of new content coming out that we thought was underdeveloped. And when we looked a little bit deeper, we realized it was because a lot of the VR companies were asking film directors to do their content. And as you may know, film directors famously show you what they want you to see. And a theater director makes sure that no matter where you look, there's something to see. Mm-hmm. And so some of the companies actually have been tapping theater directors and theater artists nowadays.
And so the new technologies are, one of them is called mixed reality, mm-hmm. MR.
Yeah.
That combines VR with live performance?
It combines VR, AR, and other ways of outputting moving image with live performance. Yeah, and that's more the realm that we're in, actually.
Okay, and AR is augmented reality,
right. So that's my favorite example of that is the Leap Motion, where you put on a retinal projector, a device that projects the image right onto your retina, and you see the real world, and the image is implanted in the real world around you.
Don't you also use holography, motion capture, voice recognition, mm-hmm. 3D animation, yes. Video mapping?
Yes, we do, yeah. That's sort of our main mode, actually, is interactivity mixed with video mapping. That's mostly what we do.
Do you see yourself as an early adopter, one of those people who likes to try out new technologies as soon as they're introduced?
I'm careful about that, but yes, we jump right on it as soon as it comes in, and sometimes we make it before it's there.
A reminder that our listeners are invited to join in the conversation. If you have any questions, if this thing is inspiring questions in you, our number here is 212-209-2877. That's 212-209-2877. A Sundance piece I mentioned earlier, Esperpento, involves something called digital puppet karaoke. Mm-hmm. What's that?
That's right. Well, so we created an immersive environment where the audience is completely surrounded by this virtual world that that Victor created. And in that world are characters. And we incorporated several different interactive technologies, the HTC Vive tracker, which tracks bodies in space and allows them to trigger events inside the virtual space, and Leap Motion, which allowed us to puppet hands to down to the finger level, and also several different techniques that allowed us to use a puppeteer to change in subtle ways the facial features of the virtual characters, and also whenever the puppeteer spoke, the virtual characters' mouths would move. So the piece, Two Black Lights and a Red One, which is the theater piece that happens inside Esperpento, the actors' mouths, as they spoke into their microphones, puppeted characters that were in the virtual space.
But it would always be the same every time anyone saw it.
It's very actually no. There's that one of the great things about it is that Victor's been able. This is one of his innovations. He's been able to create this technologically very complex world that allows interaction between the live characters and the world. So it isn't always the same. There's responsiveness between the two things, and that's also true of Analosh, Matt Romine's piece.
Another aspect of your work with Three Legged Dog is your adventures in real estate. Should we talk about your trials and tribulations here?
Sure.
You originally located in a space on West Broadway in Lower Manhattan. That was destroyed on 9/11?
Yes, yeah. We were.
What happened?
Well, we actually started a subsidiary software company with the help of the New York City Investment Fund and some European venture, social venture capital folks. We were trying to build a piece of software that we needed that didn't exist, a piece of software that allowed us to control all the different aspects of a multimedia performance from a single interface. And we had 32 employees at that time and were really going in a great direction. And then on 9/11, Fitterman Hall was destroyed when World Trade Center 7 fell on it and collapsed.
It fell on the building that you were in.
Right, yeah.
So did you lose everything?
Yeah.
How do you recover from something like that?
Well, we were the only arts group down there that had lost, our entire facility. The Lower Manhattan Cultural Council, one of their artists was lost. He was in a studio in the World Trade Center.
You mean the person died?
Yes, he died, yeah. We didn't have any deaths because we were on both a production cycle and a development cycle for the software, so everybody was working until 4 in the morning, and nobody was in the space when it was hit. So that was a good thing. But we determined that we were going to, continue that day. And so
must have had insurance at least to cover some of it.
Yeah.
You gave me a look like, no, not really.
I mean, we can have a long discussion about the problems with disaster recovery. But yeah, the insurance did cover some things, but not nearly everything. We lost, I guess, about $2.7 million in assets that day, and we finally recovered about $43,000 from the federal government a couple years later. Yeah.
So you eventually reopened the space on Greenwich Street, also in Lower Manhattan, you went there in 2006?
We took it in 2002, actually. Uh-huh. It was a space on the ground floor of the Battery parking garage, the last building that Robert Moses ever built.
And then along came Hurricane Sandy.
Yes.
Boy, yeah. You were picking bad spots, spaces.
Well, before Hurricane Sandy, the recession hit. So three natural disasters in a row. That's sort of just part of our history.
So the recession set you back because it cut into your funding?
Yeah, the funding was reduced after that for several years, yeah.
And then what happened with Hurricane Sandy? Was your space flooded?
Yeah, our space was flooded and we lost all of our pumps in the basement, and part of our fire safety system was taken out too. The whole basement flooded where a lot of our equipment was. And that we were able to replace the equipment, but what we weren't able to replace were business losses, losses from suspended operations. And
But you stayed, and then you were forced to give up that space by your landlord, the MTA?
The MTA is our landlord, yes.
Everybody hates the MTA. Do you hate the MTA for other reasons?
They're problematic, but I wouldn't say I hate them.
Well, what happened?
Well, it's the same thing. We're a not-for-profit organization, and after 9/11, we decided that we were going to, continue doing our work, and we found this space that had been abandoned for 17 years and took it over. And ultimately, like all small businesses and nonprofits, our day-to-day reality is driven by cash flow, right? And our funding, wherever it came from, went up and down, and our expenses, which were relatively high, stayed the same. And so,
you're dealing with very expensive equipment.
The equipment isn't really that expensive. What was expensive is the rent, and Con Edison is very expensive for theater groups. We pay the highest EL9 rate, so our Con Ed bill could be as high as $20,000 a month.
Wow. Mm-hmm. So you left. Mm-hmm. And now you're operating out of a studio in Brooklyn?
We're going to move into a studio in Brooklyn, 33 Flatbush, yeah, with a building that's been an arts building for many years. Yeah.
But are you finding that you need to give up the idea of a bricks and mortar a permanent home, at least for the time being?
No, I think actually that's where we've been headed for the last 5 years. We have partner studios in Berlin and Shanghai and London and L.A. and Beijing. And probably the best example is Vogue China commissioned us to design a big immersive event for them, about a 50,000 square foot design. And we talked to them, and there was a huge 150 foot by 15 foot tall wall shaped like a V that lifted up in the air with video tracking it, that opened up the room to another huge 27,000 square foot screen. And so we said, okay, well, this is a good idea. When do you want to do it? And Angelica Chung said, in 4 weeks. And so we actually activated our partner LXL in Shanghai and our partner House of North in Berlin, and working over three continents with digital technology, we were able to completely design every little nut and bolt of that project, and it went up without a hitch. And that sort of, you know, told us that we were at a certain place with our digital processes that would allow us to work in a different way.
I'm speaking to Kevin Cunningham of Three-Legged Dog. By the way, we are inviting your calls to this, inviting you to join the conversation by calling us. Our number on air is 212-209-2877. We were talking about the problem of real estate. When you first began Three-Legged Dog, wasn't it a lot easier to find vacant space to work in New York City?
Yes, it was, yeah.
So has that pretty much dried up, even in the outer boroughs?
It's getting more and more difficult, I would say, yeah. You know, part of the reality in New York now for small businesses and nonprofits is ground floor real estate. We were in competition with entities like large banks and big multinational retail chains for space.
And then there were all those wonderful industrial spaces that were available. Now they're being used in other ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Should we take a call?
Sure.
Okay, WBAI, you're on the air.
Hello, Leonard. I'm delighted you're back on the air.
Well, thank you.
And my question for Kevin is, what kind of qualifications, what kind of people do you hire? And what kind of background do they need? And the other question is, if one wanted to invest in companies, what's a good place that's publicly traded that you're aware of in this technology?
Other than Three-Legged Dog?
Are you publicly traded?
No, we're not. We're a not-for-profit organization. We're happy to take contributions, though, at any time. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, it's a very broad range, actually, because we are sort of a multivalent arts company. We do and promote all different kinds of artistic expression. All of it doesn't use technology necessarily. So we work with traditional artists like costume and scenic designers. And we also work with very, very sophisticated people who do artistic robotics and people who work as code artists, who create their artwork by writing computer code. So it's a really, really broad range of people.
If the caller would want to get in touch with you, mm-hmm. is there an email address or a website or something?
Sure. It's www.3ldnyc.org. That's the best way.
Okay.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's take another call. BAI, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I wanted to find out if you have any inquiries from the Pentagon about military uses of your technology, or whether you have already any military contracts for the use of your technology, and if so, what is the specific interest that the Pentagon would have in the work that you're doing?
This could be useful in training people for battle situations, but you were shaking your head no.
Yeah. No, we actually don't accept military contracts. And, however,
have you been approached?
We've been in proximity to to it, but. One of the stories I always tell, when we were starting our software company, we would end up at these sort of investor conferences, and there was a group that made video active jackets for rock and roll concerts, and they would show up next to us on the dais every time, and all of a sudden they disappeared, and it turned out that the Navy had bought their technology to use for camouflage.
So.
You, and VR is used for military training quite extensively now. Yeah,
but not with you. You're very much concentrating on the arts.
Yes.
Do you ever think of relocating to another city like Philadelphia, Detroit, or to one of the Hudson Valley towns that so many artists have moved to in recent years?
No, I don't think so. I think one of the great things about New York, I always say, is you can live five lives simultaneously in Manhattan, and really all you have to do is be there and be active for opportunity to present itself. So I think that's valuable. But we have found, as I said earlier, that we don't really need a big physical space anymore. We can literally design these very large scale projects effectively over multiple continents and digital using digital technology.
So you're moving into operating as a transient company? Is that why you developed a portable traveling multimedia stage?
That's one of the reasons, yeah. But the process that we've been using to design our projects is, you know, comprehensive and digital. We'll start out with a drafting set, a 3D drafting set like an architect would use, that has literally every nut and bolt incorporated into it for the design. And then we port that out to a program called Cinema 4D, which is a 3D animation and modeling software. And so we can literally make all our mistakes in the computer.
What does the portable traveling multimedia stage consist of?
So it's really quite simple. It's 6 projectors and 4 computers. And wherever we go, the venue will build some walls for us, different shapes, and we'll be able to map directly to those walls. So it's very simple to move
around. So you can take your work to film and theater festivals, mm-hmm. colleges, museums,
right.
have residencies with mm-hmm. theaters also invited you?
Yeah, pretty much everything fits into 2 road cases. So right now it looks like there's a pretty extensive European tour starting up out of Sundance. Sundance kind of showed me what the future of the company is actually in terms of who responded to the work. And so in the United States, I think we're going to be involved with some really interesting helping develop new programs at universities for digital arts. And in Europe, it's going to be about touring. And in Asia, it's going to be about, you know, probably larger scale commissions.
Well, all of your work has been on the cutting edge of theater, film, and performance, which is not the most commercially viable place to be. So how have you financed all of this stuff?
Well, since the recession in 2010, most of the money that's been used to create the new work has come from large-scale commissions. We've done a couple of times we've designed the Metropolitan Museum of Art Gala exhibit, the video for that. And we've done large-scale designs mostly in China for Vogue China and Michael Kors. And so those projects that, because of the way we work with technology, there's money left over to make art.
Is China particularly interested in all this? Haven't you been invited to do something for the 2022 Beijing Olympics?
We've been in discussions with them, and we've been invited to join them in their first workshop for the design, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a lot of it is predicted in China, yeah. that China will surpass us as the wealthiest nation in the world fairly soon, within about 15, 20 years.
Yeah.
So I guess they're also preparing for whatever the future might bring, and they would see this as one of the things that the future might bring?
There are actually in many ways more opportunities in China for experimentation in art and technology, and I think that the Chinese government and also the corporate folks that are working in this area see much more clearly the connection between artistic experimentation and technological advancement.
Does Mike Pompeo know about that?
Apparently not.
Do you have a teaching program to train young artists in these new technologies?
We have developed a program. We've for many years have offered different training programs for artists at 3LD. And I'm currently working with a couple of different universities on developing different parts of a curriculum for digital arts. We tried to start one a few years ago at a major university, and we sort of ran into a wall at a certain point because the traditional folks that were teaching the 19th century genres.
Well, you mean the theater program people felt threatened?
And the film people and the architecture. That's the thing about the digital technology.
But you think that they would see this as something that they could incorporate into what they're trying to do?
You would think, yeah.
You would think.
I think there's some movement on that now, finally. There are multiple programs that are starting up around the country. Up to now, it's been sort of spotty. You know, people have developed programs, but they're just a video design program. The reality is, in the arts, the real innovation in technology has been in the capacity of an artist to work across disciplines. these technologies that help things that aren't supposed to talk to each other anyway, and that coordinate, lighting, sound, video, interactivity in a single interface so that everything is much more integrated. That's the real change in technology for theater especially.
Have you received grants from major cultural institutions like the Rockefeller Foundation, the NEA,
mm-hmm.
Guggenheim?
Yeah, we haven't received a Guggenheim. Several of our artists have. We received two Rockefeller Foundation Cultural Innovation Fund grants, both of them related to either business innovation for nonprofits or technology in the arts.
And I'm assuming that because of your special situation, you've become an expert in cultivating alternative sources
yeah.
of funding.
I have. My expertise only goes so far.
But because I've heard that there's been a decline in philanthropic support for the mm-hmm. arts in recent years.
I think that's true. I think that there's been a decline, especially for small and mid-sized organizations, yeah.
Which comes
or a change. Maybe it's a shift from institutional to individual.
Because just recently heard that something like 26 families have more money than half mm-hmm. of the people in the world.
Yeah.
You would think that some of them would just see something that you're doing as interesting, at least throw you a couple thousand bucks.
It happens sometimes. It does. Yeah.
Should we take another call? Oh, no. Okay. That call fell through. Do all nonprofit organizations need to put a lot of effort into fundraising or development, as it's now being called?
I think it's true that's a major part of everything a nonprofit.
So how do you go about that?
Well, we've always relied on a mix of traditional fundraising and of non-traditional fundraising like commissioned work.
And can you get the equipment manufacturers to lend or donate?
Sometimes.
We have another caller.
Sure.
Okay, WBAI, you're on the air. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
How you doing?
We're doing fine. Hello? You want to speak to Kevin Cunningham?
That'd be great.
Go ahead.
Hello.
Hello, Mr. Cunningham?
Yes.
Hi. Well, my name is Stuart. I'm from New York, and I've got retina problems, and I see that this might be some area that you could get people to do some research in.
Mm.
They could project pictures right directly onto the retina.
Yeah.
And that would be a big help.
It has interesting possibilities. It does. Yeah.
So he actually would benefit from the latest technology?
Maybe. It depends. I'm not a doctor.
Are all sorts of different issues that people
yeah.
have mm-hmm. with their sight. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering whether that affects their experience. For example, my eyes are uneven. My left eye is myopic.
Right.
My right eye is not.
Mm-hmm.
This is the way the... I was born. You understand.
I certainly do.
So
I have retinal degeneration,
mm-hmm,
where
mm-hmm.
the eye becomes a more and more elongated egg,
right?
Mm-hmm. Instead of remaining round.
Yeah.
So, is this something that is being taken into consideration, or do
I know there are many people
just have to adjust
that are working on this. We work with a man named Cohen Bisa, who's an MD that works across art technology and medical technology, and I know that he's worked a lot with both the blind community and people who have hearing issues to develop these ways of expressing themselves and ways of receiving art. And one of the things about immersion in art is that it doesn't rely on one or the other sense. It's a completely a multisensory experience.
Okay. I hope that works out for you. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Now, you mentioned earlier people looking at their phones.
Mm-hmm.
I can envision a time in the near future when this becomes much more available where now everybody in the elevator, instead of looking at their shoes, looks at their phone.
Right.
But if you are riding the subway, I would say that two-thirds of the people in the subway are either looking at their phones or listening to something through headphones,
right.
All ways of not having to deal with other people.
Mm-hmm.
Am I going to wind up riding the subway and looking at a whole bunch of people with these things over their eyes?
Possibly. It's possible.
Will they be portable, easily?
Yeah. I think the next iteration is sort of a combination over-ear earphone and an eyepiece that's in front of one of your eyes. Yeah.
I think we could slip one more call in here. Hi, BAI, you're on the air.
I can barely hear you. Can you speak up? Hi.
We're speaking as loudly as we can. Hi.
Hi. I'm calling for...
You know what you should do? You should turn down your radio because there's a slight delay and you're getting confused.
Specific information about Kevin Cunningham, where I can contact him, okay? Mm-hmm. Then I don't have to get up and walk to the radio. But I like to contact him. I'm an artist, a lighting designer. Mm-hmm. And I would like to communicate with him further, please.
Yes, you can reach me through our website at www.3ldnyc.org. And there'll be a contact.
I can barely hear you. Can you say it a little bit louder?
3LD, the number 3, LDNYC.org.
No, when you say 3, can you spell the next two letters?
It's just the number 3.
3LDNYC.org. Okay.
This is hopeless because I don't get what you're saying after 3.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know why we're speaking pretty clearly. I think that you have your radio on and that's really confusing.
I have a very bad telephone. That's what the problem is. Okay. Well,
okay.
I'll check back later with Leonard Lopez.
Okay.
And ask him to provide information where I can contact him.
Okay. If you get in touch with us here at WBAI, somebody will pass that information on. We don't have a lot of time left, but I was wondering if you have some other projects in the future other than the possibility of the Beijing Olympics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well...
What would happen at the Beijing Olympics? Because you can't... You have mm-hmm. how many people in a stadium? 75, 100,000 people?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They're not all going to be wearing those things, are
no,
they?
No. We'll be doing something with mapping, probably. You know, something where we try to take over the entire space with moving image and light. Mm-hmm.
Almost like using holograms?
We might use holograms in that one. One of the things that people are interested in our designs is our ability to layer images and create these large-scale dimensional images.
Are there any things coming up in New York City in the near future that people might be able to get a sense of what you're all about?
Right now we're in the process of talking to some other folks about co-producing the two next works we're working on. One is an expansion of the Three-Fifths project that I talked about earlier with James Scruggs, and the other is a ongoing collaboration that I have with the playwright Chuck Mee called Not Knowing, both immersive theater works. So we're working on those, and we're hoping to have one or the other of those up in the next year or so. And then the Sundance experience that we built, it looks like it's going to be touring Europe and maybe going to a couple of other places in the States, in California and Nebraska specifically.
But I didn't hear you say New York City.
I didn't hear, yeah. we're really focusing New York on our own original productions, Three-Fifths and Not Knowing.
Okay. It's been a great pleasure learning about all of this from you. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you.
Kevin Cunningham, the founder and executive artistic director of Three-Legged Dog Media and Theater Group. And this is separate, 3LD Art and Technology Center. Mm-hmm. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. My great thanks to Kevin Cunningham, to Barbara Kahn, who produced this segment, to Reggie Johnson, who was at the audio controls, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, and to my executive producer, Jesse Lent. Leonard Lopate at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.